people to control their destiny. So I think it's about the biggest crisis of our country today, and I do think Elizabeth Warren speaks most eloquently to this, is the rigged system. The rigged system. Money, power, politics, the fusion of that, not just at home, but as in that Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, the global rigged rules, which are shafting working people. So how people take back power, you know, one of the reasons the nation, and I think democracy now may stay in business, to use a crass term, for many years is, you know, I don't believe there are any lost causes. There are a lot of causes to be fought for, but there are only causes waiting to be won. And organized people, and this is, as I said, a time when people are in motion. I think you got Black Lives Matter, you got post-Occupy, you have the fight for 15, you have the fast food workers, you have migrant rights, immigrant rights movements. I mean, there's a sense that something is happening and people are aching for a better America that works for people, not just, as this Trans-Pacific Partnership illuminates most clearly, corporations.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation, America's oldest weekly magazine. We will link to your website, The Nation, celebrating its 150th anniversary with a quintuple-length blockbuster edition of the magazine. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Sarah Mate, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Susan Griffin, Sustainability in the Soul, Thursday, April 9th, 7 p.m. in the Sanctuary. Susan Griffin is an internationally celebrated writer who will speak on the false divisions our culture makes between body and soul, masculine and feminine, self and other, that allow us to hide from our own knowledge. Again, that's Susan Griffin, Sustainability in the Soul, Thursday, April 9th, 7 p.m. in the Sanctuary, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is proud to present a live broadcast of the Inner City Blues Festival, a benefit for Healthcare for All Oregon, from the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter at North Lombard in Portland, Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. Hear live performances from such local blues and R&B luminaries as LaRonda Steele, Norman Sylvester Band, and many more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival live broadcast and show on Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
We're at the Erez Crossing, which is where you enter Gaza from. So apparently, when you go into Gaza, you have to walk until you get to the first town there. And apparently that walk is very dangerous.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom, Thursday, April 9th at 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University's Smith Center, room 338. Guest speaker will be Stephen Saleta, former Virginia Tech professor. That's Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom, sponsored by Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, on Thursday, April 9th, 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University, Smith Center, room 338. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers, since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont, and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com.
It's like the time that this minister in Indiana claimed that the theme song for Mr. Ed, the old television show about the talking horse, if you played the Mr. Ed theme song backwards, it said, Satan is the source.
Misinformation.
Taking scissors to play with the black folk down in Florida. Colored pens and for sexing up the... I'm the someone who knew, and I'm telling pre-September. I lean on in the loop to help them unremember.
I was flying on UA-93. That shadow in the footage, it was probably me. I'm the rumor, I'm the doubt, I'm the lie. But you wouldn't stand near me.
On behalf of the Department of Energy, I'm very excited to announce today a great new plan. It's beginning a process that will do nothing less than convert the United States energy grid into one that's powered entirely by renewable sources. By 2030, America will produce 100% of our energy from renewables, establishing us once again as a beacon of innovation and progress, and as a global leader in confronting the supreme challenge of climate change.
Yes, at a meeting of the Homeland Security Congress, dozens of military contractors and lobbyists were hoodwinked into believing a fictitious new government plan called the American Renewable Clean Energy Network. Benedict Waterman, the man you just saw speaking, was actually Andy Biklbaum of the Yes Men. And his talk was followed up by another impassioned speech from someone calling themselves Banna Slowhorse of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, who was actually Gets Crazy Boy, an indigenous tar sands activist. Following these talks, Crazy Boy passed out native...
And good morning. You are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO. That was my little April Fool's beginning to this very non-April Fool's program on climate change. And we're going to have our guest, Robert Hunsaker, a journalist from Los Angeles in the heart of drought-stricken California, on with us this morning to talk about catastrophism and climate change, the issue of how do we talk about this issue, which is so truly overwhelming and really difficult to get a handle on, because it is happening at such a level that is so far beyond our ability to really comprehend. That's what we're going to talk about. There's a book that came out a couple years ago, Catastrophism, The Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth, that stirred up a certain amount of discussion and controversy over precisely this issue. Are climate change activists, or certain ones of them, being alarmist? Is talking about climate change in certain ways, is it paralyzing and disempowering? Rather than inciting people to action. What do you think about it? We're going to invite you to call in maybe about 10 minutes or so at 503-231-8187. And Robert Hunsaker, as you heard Steve earlier, is a journalist who has come up with a new article out on Counterpunch just a couple days ago called Apocalyptic Meltdown, The Nightmare is Underway. And it's exactly that kind of language which is stirring up differences of opinion. So we're going to be talking about this morning. Robert, are you with us?
Yeah, I am. Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm pretty well. So are you able to take showers down there in Los Angeles now?
No, no more showers.
No more
And no brushing of teeth and no shaving. You know, it is a serious problem. And not only that, I wrote an article about this not too long ago because I found out that the people who are fracking for oil and gas in California, California is the fourth largest oil and gas producing state, the fracking people actually putting their wastewater into aquifers, the drinking water, and that's been discovered. And it's horrendous to think that that's happening, but it is. That's another subject altogether, though, isn't it?
Well, it's very related, especially for you all who live in California and are going to perhaps have some actually difficulties getting drinking water. And, you know, who knows how long? I mean, basically the aquifers are being drawn down at a rapid rate since there's barely any surface water anymore.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, in the Central Valley, the land is actually dropping by 1 foot per year because of that dramatic drawdown of the aquifers. So, you know, the big question mark is nobody really knows for certain exactly how much water is down there. And it's truly a serious, serious, serious problem. And we've had a very dry winter, once again. And the Sierra Mountains got very little snow. So it's going to be a tough year for California.
Well, you know, on a related note, I noticed that I think it was about a week ago that a bunch of people symbolically shut down or surrounded the Nestle water bottling plant, I believe in Sacramento, somewhere around there. That was kind of inspiring. That since what the same thing, they're bottling all this water and sending it all over the world in plastic bottles, no less, when people are having difficulty getting drinkable water.
Listen, Paul, we live in a crazy world. It's upside down in so many ways. And that goes back to another call we should have someday about eco-economics versus neoliberal economics. There is a school of thought of eco-economics where the economy works in harmony with nature rather than working against nature. And right now, the economies are working against nature. We've got to stop that.
Indeed, indeed. So let's get into the subject. Obviously, we're going to be talking about your most recent piece for Counterpunch about the state of climate change as you're able to assess it, specifically the meltdown of the Arctic sea ice, Antarctica, and glaciers all over the world as key indicators of what's going on in real time with climate change. And we're going to be also talking about the subject I brought up, which is the idea that some people have, especially this book, as I mentioned earlier, that came out a couple years ago, the idea that overemphasizing, quote, apocalyptic scenarios can actually be disempowering, may tend to ignore or downplay the actual disastrous social conditions that many non-privileged people have to live in. In the book, Catastrophism, the Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth, the authors argue that, quote, catastrophe can be paralyzing, not mobilizing. Revolutionaries should be talking about possibilities of transformation, not spinning tales of great chaos and suffering. What are the most effective ways of talking about this climate change and other social and environmental disasters? So that's what we're going to be talking about. Again, the numbers are, the number is 503-231-8187. So what are your thoughts? Before we get into the subject of your piece, what are your initial thoughts of this subject that I brought up?
Well, here's my initial thought. I believe that the American public has been lulled into a false sense of security about the climate issue. And I think that comes from two sources. One is the scientific community, and secondly, the denialist community. Now, on the scientific side, scientists are by nature and by training extraordinarily conservative people. They're not radicals at all. In fact, one of their biggest concerns is that they ever be labeled an extremist. So they have a tendency to err on the side of conservatism. And we've seen that in science that has come out about global warming, climate change over the last couple of decades. And let's also keep in mind, this whole issue is very, very fresh and very young. It was only 1987 when James Hansen testified before a Senate committee and said that we've detected global greenhouse gases that will lead to global warming. So this is all still really young, new stuff. And everyone's still trying to sort it out. But the scientific community has been should shoulder a lot of the blame for the apathetic attitude of the public, because they have a tendency to downplay the science rather than tell it like it is. Now, the other issue that's had an impact has been the fact that several hundred million dollars has been filtered through various 501c, phony 501c's by sources like the Koch brothers, ExxonMobil, the fossil fuel industry. They've hidden funds that have been sourced into paying off scientists, for example. We just saw an example of this recently with Dr. Soon, who it was uncovered that he was receiving huge grants from the fossil fuel industry, and that he was exchanging emails with them. I've got a new really good one, on and on it goes. So scientists can be bought. And not only that, they set up phony websites like Climate Depot that people go to. And these their whole agenda has been to create doubt about global warming in the minds of the American public. And they control the media, too, by the way, in a lot of ways. And so the combination of those two things, of scientists being ultra-conservative and careful with their words, and then superimposed on top of that, this massive undercover covert operation where they have tried to influence the American public into questioning the legitimacy of global warming, and that is anthropogenic or man-made global warming, and they succeeded very well. So I kind of take the opposite tack of the book that you're referring to. Now, in theory, what they say, sure, it's true. If you're shrill and shrill with shrilly type of headlines all the time and so forth and so on, people do push away from that. However, my belief is that honest environmental journalists let the hard science speak for itself. And if you let the words of hard science dictate, like my article, for example, that's all peer review science there that I've quoted throughout that article. And if you read that and sit back and think about it, it is an apocalyptic meltdown situation that we're in. Plain facts, the hard science is right there in black and white. So I think that needs to get into the public. I think people need to hear the message because they need to take action, and we need to take political action. We need to make, you know, listen, because of the Republicans taking over the Congress, what do we have now? Who do we have now overseeing the committees on science for this country? Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, both climate denialists. Well, where's that going to put us? So we need to, the more educated the people are, and I think there needs to be some sense of alarm out there because they're way too complacent about this issue. And that's my view.
So before we get to our first caller, who I see we have, let me just ask you, what's new, you know, what's new that has struck you, you know, what that you wrote a new article to address the current situation? I know you've had, you know, over the past few months, you've had quite a few articles about the methane releases and the possibility of large scale methane releases from underneath the Arctic and the permafrost as a possible kick into a greatly accelerated climate change. That's something you've written about recently. You've written very provocatively about the idea of refreezing the Arctic. You kind of threw out this sort of idea of actually, you know, geoengineering that, you know, people talk about geoengineering, but you sort of put it out there as well. You know, we're not doing anything. See, this is the way I took it anyway. We're not doing anything else. And, you know, if we keep going the way we are, we could actually completely change the climate regime to the extent that it makes the Earth uninhabitable. So maybe we should put our technology to bear. Refreeze the Arctic was an article. So what led you to read? To write this recent article about the melting ice.
Yeah, well, Paul, just within the last few weeks, some new scientific research has come out, peer review scientific research, relative to the CryoSat 2 satellite that was launched by Europe back in 2010. And what they've been able to do with that is they have been able to thoroughly analyze what's happening with the ice mass in Antarctica for the first time, actually, ever. And what they found to their amazement is that the Antarctica is losing ice mass at twice the rate of loss that they've ever thought before. So this was a real wake-up call for our Earth scientists. And that's the new data that's just out there now. And, you know, it takes that long. It takes 5 years to really accumulate and analyze and figure these things out. Now, don't forget, when we talk about ice shells in Antarctica, we're talking about a very tenuous situation. For example, it was only a decade ago that the Larsen B ice shelf disintegrated and collapsed into the oceans. In fact, some American scientists were there during the summer in Antarctica, and they noticed the Larsen B, which is a huge cantilevered ice shelf out over the sea, and they noticed that the waterfalls were huge coming down the sides of it, just enormous like they'd never seen before. The Larsen B was 1,250 square miles. Now, by the time those American scientists got back to the United States, the Larsen B had totally collapsed into the ocean. It was a major wake-up call for scientists. It shattered like the glass of a car's windshield over several weeks. That's all it took. That's how abruptly these things can happen. In my article, I mentioned two major ice shelves that are irreversibly coming apart now, although no one knows the exact timing of this. One's the Toden, which is 90 miles by 20 miles. If an entire Toden ice shelf were to collapse the way the Larsen B did, you have 11 feet of, I'd be wearing scuba gear. It'll increase the oceans by 11 feet. That's how much ice that is. Now, scientists say it could take centuries, and it probably will take centuries for that to happen. But the problem is not the centuries. The problem, Paul, is the durable progression year over year over year as it releases more and more ice, more flow into the oceans. Very slowly, what happens is we start to lose our coastal communities. For example, we've got a real live example of that today at the Outer Banks, east of North Carolina. It's a 200-mile island, very well known. 57,000 people permanently live there. It's a huge tourist. It has great beaches, a huge tourist attraction. On the Outer Banks, there are portions where the width of the island is 25% of what it originally was because the waters are just eating down the landmass. Well, not only that, there's a major highway called Major Highway 12 that runs the entire length, and they have problems with it buckling, with it getting washed out more and more and more. And there's a marine scientist named Orbach, who I quote in my article out of Duke, who made mention that, you know, people for years have been warning us this is going to happen. Now we're seeing it happen and we don't know what to do.
Okay, let's take a little break right there go to our first caller. Sean, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I've been a pretty regular caller to KBOO over the last several years. And, you know, I'm kind of guilty of dropping names like Derek Jensen and Michael Parenti and Bob Avakian, only because those are the only people I read that seem to divert a little bit from the standard leftist analysis, which goes something like, we need to establish worker-owned collectives and have decentralized energy production and so on and so forth. And my problem with that is it never seems to address the most fundamental question, which is, where does the leverage come from? Our intellectual persuasion never works. Our moral persuasion never works. I don't care whether we're talking about the environment, foreign policy, Wall Street. Where does the leverage come from to push back. And I don't see that coming anywhere on the left right now. And so I just appreciate your comments on that. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yeah, Paul, do you have any thought on that? I do. I mean, I think he's right on the money there. Where does our leverage come from? And we've lost our leverage because the government and the entire system has been hijacked by a very plutocratic, wealthy class of people, quite frankly. This starts with Wall Street. It really does. And how do you get that back? I think the only way you can really do it is on a local basis in politics and bring people up through the system. But, boy, that's hard to do. I wish I had an answer. Do you have one, Paul?
Do I have a answer? I'm not sure there is one answer. I do know that we can't rely on the same kind of grand dreams of the future, I guess is kind of how I would characterize it. The idea that if we slowly build it, slowly we will build a mass force that will change things. I think that the time for that was perhaps in the late 19th to early 20th century, when there was a factory system where large numbers of people actually worked together and actually could organize together. And I think those days are gone. I think some people are still perhaps living in those days, which is not to say that, you know, all the various oppressed and, people who are forced to give their labor or whatever, their blood, sweat, and tears to make this system continue to run, aren't the people who could possibly and hopefully will stop it. But I think you're right. I think that there's a movement that does seem to be growing kind of out of a lot of it out of the direct action environmental movement and, you know, related environmental justice, the tar sands blockade, the various individual fights against fossil fuel infrastructure, you know, whether it's fracking, whether it's pipelines, whether it's export terminals that are going on, you know, around the country and here in the Northwest. I have some announcements of some things that are actually going on right here that I will read in a few minutes. I'll just read one right now. Southwest Washington, the oil industry sacrifice zone. That's today at 6 p.m. at the Kiggins Theater at 1011 Main Street in Vancouver, Washington. Join Eric DePlace of Sightline Institute and listen to what he says about the oil industry's plan for us. Eric will then moderate a panel including Lauren Goldberg of Columbia Riverkeeper, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bart Hansen and McInerney, Ogle, various others for a community discussion on what the oil industry has in store for Southwest Washington and learn what you can do. That they're talking about oil terminals, oil trains. So you can get up to speed if you live in Vancouver, if you live in Southwest Washington, get yourself to the Kiggins Theater in Vancouver this evening at 6 o'clock. And we've got several other announcements of the about the Pembina oil proposed propane terminal. Next week, there will be a public hearing on that. And I will talk about those towards the end of the program. But let's go to our next caller.
Paul, one more thing. One more.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
One more response to Sean. Let's go back to the 60s. When people hit the streets, it made a big difference. And Martin Luther King made a difference. That's how we got the Civil Rights Act. When people go to the streets, it makes a difference. And the People's Climate March that took place in New York has made a difference already in many ways. So go ahead to your next call.
Nick, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Nick, my first-time caller. I'm a bit nervous. I apologize. But one thing to think about, the climate change is such a huge issue, but one thing to think about it is, and I'm glad you brought up big corporations and big money being a part of it, what if there was a way for them to profit off this disaster? For instance, what's going on in California with the humongous drought is that they're privatizing a lot of the wells and aquifers, and they're going to spend billions of dollars in public and private money to update their water treatment systems. Could this crisis be somewhat manufactured in order to make a profit. And I'm not saying it's not happening. I'm all for, less pollution and that sort of thing. But do you think they could spin this in such a way that it could be for nefarious reasons?
The entire drought that's happening in California in the Southwest is manufactured, you're saying?
Well, that's another thing, too, is, if it was, if you could, there's futures you can bet on. I forget exactly how they do it, but they basically, water futures, crop futures, they basically can bet on it like a casino. And if you know the game, you can rig it. If you know where all the water is that's in the ground and you privatize it and you can sell that off to farmers at an exorbitant price.
I'm just not understanding. So you're saying that there actually may not be a drought? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, well, no. What I'm saying is, what if you didn't really want to fix it? You could make more money that way. Do you think that also brings me to the subject, if you really want to get a little wonky, keep an open mind, they're talking about geoengineering, and they're saying they're not doing it, but living in California and you see the planes crisscrossing the sky with whatever white clouds that is, that's a possibility too. I don't know. This is the 21st century. Maybe they can control the weather, but let's... If you don't want to go there, I understand.
No. Let's let Robert talk about the idea that maybe they're not addressing the drought because there's profit. They're not dealing with it because there's profit to be made. What do you think, Robert?
Well, I think what is happening gets right back to what you talked about at the top of the show, and that is the demonstration in Northern California against Nestle, and that's privatizing our water, taking the public's water and selling it to the world. I think that where Nick is maybe sniffing up the right pole is exactly that. And now, water privatization is one of the huge issues that's taking place worldwide. There's no doubt that you've got moneyed interest taking advantage of this situation. They can't control. They can't control the weather, create a drought, but they're certainly taking advantage of the drought situation. And we should not be shipping one drop of water in plastic bottles outside of California. Shouldn't even put it in plastic bottles to begin with. But I think. In part, Nick is right, that the moneyed interests are taking advantage of things. And, this all gets back to this whole neoliberal economy we've got. Neoliberalism was coined by Milton Friedman in 1951 in a paper that he wrote. And then, of course, Reagan and Thatcher both picked up on it. And they said, gee, that's a great idea. We privatize everything. We get rid of all these social programs and put it all into the capitalistic structure. Everybody profits a lot. The problem is there's no trickle down. Profit stays all at the top. That's the problem.
Well, the whole issue of whether how much or whether it's a manufacturer crisis. I think at the level of municipalities and the state itself. I mean, this is like total crisis. I mean, I think that, you're going to see, I think what you're going to see is really a striking the conflict between the public sector and the private sector is just going to accentuate dramatically.
Absolutely.
Because
Absolutely.
The costs that are associated with trying to get water to people. You're going to see it between the conflict between industry uses. You're already seeing it, the conflict between, the agriculture of California, which, feeds a good part of the country and the world, is like, they got to keep that going for now. That's why so much of the water is being pumped out of those aquifers to continue the California agriculture. And I think unless it starts raining at some point, you're going to have to see a conflict between actual daily, absolute daily needs of individual human beings and all these other, corporate, private, industrial needs. So that's good. And I think, the municipalities are going to have to start fighting harder for themselves. So, you're going to, I don't think it's. I don't think it's a given necessarily that the private interests are going to win out because, people have to drink, people have to clean themselves, people need water to wash their dishes and everything else. So it's going to get interesting, if not terribly horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, Sao Paulo, I wrote an article about Sao Paulo in Brazil. They're actually, their reservoirs are down to 6% now, and they literally will run out of water. They're shutting down the water supply every day now at 1 p.m. In that city of 20 million people. 1 p.m. every day they shut off the water. They turn it on the next morning sometimes by 10 or 11 a.m. So people have running water for 3 or 4 hours a day, because their reservoirs are so low, and there's 20 million people that could run out of water within 12 months. Where do they go? So there are a lot of issues out there, and a lot that whole issue there has a lot to do with the loss of the rainforest and how that controls weather patterns throughout that part of the rainforest. It has a huge impact on weather patterns. So, yeah, these are the kind of things that... maybe all of this is going to bring to a head, and we get back to Sean's comment about the left is left dangling, and where are they, and they're so weak, and true, the left has become very weak. This may be the kind of thing that where there's a groundswell, and people start to realize there's a better way, and they start looking to their left instead of their right.
Well, you know, the unions, where are they on all this fossil fuel infrastructure? You know, there's always a few that for whatever reason, possibly sometimes as moral reasons, sometimes it's their own rather parochial, employment sector reasons, just to speak very frankly, I think that's the case, that they'll go against a particular fossil fuel infrastructure. I won't name names, but in general, they're totally absent. You know, they'll have a big presence at, like in Seattle, the Turtle Labor Alliance, but that really never developed into much, because when it comes down to brass tacks, you know, the unions have completely abdicated a broader critique and any kind of revolutionary, antagonism towards the existing economic system itself. And they've totally devolved into basically protecting the interests, which are legitimate, obviously. People need to have safe workplaces, and they need, decent salaries and benefits. But, as Earth First used to say, there are no jobs on a dead planet. So I think that, I don't know where it's going to happen, but somehow there's got to be some shakedown, and the unions are going to have to, come out for a total economic transformation, whether you call it a green economy, you can call it whatever you want, but there has to be some vision of a radical economic tech infrastructural transformation. Anyway, we've got a couple more callers. Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me. Thanks for the show. I love and hate talking about this all at the same time, because it's absolutely terrifying and absolutely necessary. There's a paradox, right? Because what's becoming clear is the solution and the way out of this is that we need to really descale our lives, and we have to localize as much of our individual and collective economy as possible. But at the same time, that's going to require some collective action and centralized planning in order to really make that happen, because we are in a global capitalist economic system. So without the consent of at least some of the players in that global economic system, which is based on all of us, it's going to be a lot harder to really make the necessary changes, because the profit motive is not going to stop. And corporations are not just going to decide to change. We're going to have states that actually force those changes on those entities, which are quickly gaining more power than any individual state on the planet, right? If this Trans-Pacific Partnership goes through, every nation within that partnership essentially abdicates all of their authority. Our Constitution, we can just throw it out the window, right? So...
Yeah, it accentuates the process that's basically already here. I mean, the ability of people to actually stop large destructive projects is very limited, as the whole community rights movement points out, which basically goes back to the the U.S. Constitution itself and its privileging of private commerce, interstate commerce over the public interest, which basically led to, you know, where we're at now. But yeah, I mean, it just gets worse and worse.
Yeah. And then, you know, the guest here, I'm sorry, I forget your name, but
Robert Hunsaker.
You talk about the groundswell, right? And I'm seeing the groundswell too, but what's the response going to be? And, you know, looking at, you know, the People's Climate March was pretty cool, but it's not the same as, say, the Black Lives Matter movement that has stayed, you know what I mean? And so while that was a great spectacle, it doesn't have the same on-the-ground, in-your-face, everyday kind of dynamic that, say, the Ferguson situation has. And when we look at what the response has been to the situation in Ferguson, I think that gives us an indication of what we can expect in terms of the levers of power and how they'll respond to groundswell on climate.
Well, let's cross that bridge when we get to it. I mean, let's not worry too much ahead of time. I mean, we should be prudent, of course, but
because I think we have to put that into the calculus, though, that what's happening with the militarization of police is an issue that we definitely have to consider when we're talking about really radically changing the entire system that, as you say, goes back at least to the Constitution and even farther back to, you know, if you listen to Richard Grossman, Paul Cienfuegos, it goes back to, you know, the imperial authority of European monarchs, right? So we're really talking about flipping a massive system that is deeply ingrained in Western culture that has now spread across the planet. And we can't just expect that because this is extremely dangerous that, you know, those folks who have power because they have the wealth are simply going to roll over, and that they're not going to utilize every single means at their disposal to resist the popular movement. I mean, there's no movement. You talk about the labor movement, the civil rights movement, every single one of them was met with state and federal and local resistance and brutality. So,
well, and it was also met by a massive...
We have to put that into the calculus.
Sure, sure. It was also met by a massive co-optation, you know, is probably the more effective response was the way the labor movement was bought off and the way the environmental movement gets co-opted by the large green organizations that are working in league with large Democratic Party affiliated funders and so on and so on. Yeah, we got to take all that into account.
I don't want to take up too much more time, but I'm an educator, and I see education as one key. It's the long game, but we've got to take the infrastructure that we have, almost 100,000 public schools in this country, and what would happen if we could leverage that in the same way that Kennedy leveraged public education to say we need to put a man on the moon, if you ascribe to that as being an actual historical fact, which I do, that we can do the same thing with climate change, that we can turn our school systems into solution laboratories where our students are being trained to understand the dynamics and the complexity of this problem, and then we're setting them up with the skills and the resources that they need in order to experiment with the best possible solutions people's needs.
You're also gonna, you know, you're gonna have massive pushback in that too. So the point goes back to our first caller, was where is the leverage on making any of these things happen? And so you have to start with, you know, if sure, Portland Public Schools is a pretty progressive place. I think that's a great place. I think people should talk to the, you know, I don't know if you're involved with Rethinking Schools. You know, there's a lot of, you know, so yeah, I think that's a great place to put energy.
But it's got to scale up quickly, right? Because this problem is much bigger than Portland, right?
Indeed.
Anyway, hey, I really appreciate you guys having this conversation, and I really look forward to hearing the rest of it.
All right, thanks for calling.
Thank you,
Robert. You've just been taking all this in. What do you think?
Very deep subject. Well, one thing we could do is we could ask to those 100,000 schools around the country to all paint their roofs white. That's one thing that helps. You know, here's the other thing, though. There's a better way, and we've got firm evidence of it. Go to Denmark. I was there not too long ago, and my son had an accident on his toe. We had to go to the emergency room, and they took some time to take care of him, gave him crutches and so forth. And when I went to the front desk to pay, I thought it cost me $2,500, and they said, no, just bring the crutches back before you leave the country. In Denmark, and the reason I bring this up, a lot of business is owned in co-ops. And co-ops are something that are starting to, when I talked earlier about a groundswell on a local basis, one of the things I was going to reference happens to be co-ops, because it's a way to fight back and for people to own businesses in mass. And it works very well in countries like Denmark. And everyone there is taxed 50%, and they all accept it. But all education is free. I went to visit my mother-in-law's cousin, who was in a really nice townhome provided by the state. They got meals every day provided by the state. And you know what? Everybody in Denmark, they're all happy with what they've got. So there's a better way. One of the things that's happening in this country is you do have a groundswell of co-ops. It's several on the East Coast that are owning businesses, where the people together own the businesses, and hopefully something like that can spread as well. But getting back to climate change, and that's what this whole thing is all about. listen, I oftentimes in my articles mention the space station. And the reason I mention the space station is that Congress funds the space station. Well, now, the harshest environment that we know of, Paul, is outer space. No gravity, huge, extreme temperatures. And they get along just fine up there for a decade. And have you ever seen a space shuttle with a load of coal fly to the space station? No. So here we have Congress funding the space station that is 100% solar-powered 24/7. And when it goes into the shadow, they have fuel cells that are also recharged when the sun's shining on the solar arrays. So 24/7 solar. If we can do it in outer space, we can do it in this country as well. And that's why I continually try to bring, and in this recent article of mine, I bring that up. That when Dr. Orbach, the marine scientist from Duke University, who talked about what's already happening with the Outer Banks in North Carolina, where it's losing the shoreline to a rising ocean, where they lose the highway time and again. Property values are under threat. 57,000 people live there. When he said that we don't know what to do, my next paragraph in that article was, well, geez, we've got the answer. Tell Congress if they can build it in outer space, we can build it in this damn country. Let's do it. So I just think that when there's a general ignorance in the country, or an apathy, I don't know which it is, maybe it's a combination of the two, about the climate change issue, that one thing we can all do is spread the word. Everyone knows somebody else. So talk about it to people. And the program you're having today, these kind of programs are crucial for people to, I think, you know, take their awareness levels up. And everybody needs to become an activist. Don't just sit around in an easy chair. Become an activist. Do something. There are things that can be done. Think about it. If you think about it every day, after several days, all of a sudden something pops into your mind. So, I think we have to take, you know, the reins and do, as individuals, whatever you can do to make it a better world.
Well, let's go to our next caller. Gee, you're on the air.
Morning. Hey, you hit on a lot of good topics there. I'm sorry about my throat. I think if you get a root cause, you always might try and get to the root causes, and I think education is excellent because people are aware of the situations and what can be done. There's probably not going to be a new technology that, you know, the silver bullet that saves us all and all that sort of thing. But there'll always be these incremental changes that will keep making batteries, solar power, wind, and other green technologies better and better over time. And so that'll help, although that's a long-term solution. But I think you need to get down to a root, and one of it is definitely money and politics, that you mentioned that before. And if you don't change that, it's going to be very, very difficult to get the elite out of their controlling power. And I think, too, with the co-opting, where people own their businesses, they have more stake in the businesses, and they become owners, too. Everyone would be an owner, and that would make people more empowered. But I don't think we should look at any kind of silver bullet saving our asses or anything like that. But in the green sector, there's a lot of jobs to be had. So I know people need jobs right now, and there's a lot of jobs that can be had. And I think we're not addressing that as quickly as we can. Money is being spent in the wrong places, like defense.
It's true. We all know it. Yeah.
Whereas people's homes, I look around here and a bunch of decrepit old homes, basically from the 20s and earlier, are basically energy sieves. And I don't think they're being updated and taken care of well enough, quickly enough, to help reduce the amount of energy used.
Right. Well, there needs to be obviously a massive, massive deployment of resources from absurd, destructive, and wasteful things like the warfare economy and fossil fuel and packaging and all that. And we all are wishing and hoping that we can do that. But the problem is that the economic system is geared in that the political, military, economic system is geared in that direction and doesn't seem to want to change. So we have to, again, the first caller, what is the leverage point to making it change? And I thank you for your call. What's your last?
Yeah, I think you're just simply not going to change human nature, and there's always going to be this greed factor.
Well, wait a second. How'd human nature get into it?
Human nature, well, that's what people, if people are part of this problem, causing this problem, the greed, say like the fossil fuel industry.
Well, is greed human nature?
Well, I mean, if you think about like the seven deadly sins, I mean, greed's one of them.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I'm not trying to push a religious thing, but I'm just saying it's part of people tend, you know, there are a certain percentage of people that tend to be very greedy. And so that tends to skew, since they collect this money power, they also have political power. And so you may not be able to change some of that, but you might be able to utilize.
But isn't greed an expression of a social expression that comes out in certain social context? I think that not all human societies have the kind of, as you call, greed and great separation between the wealthy, privileged few and the masses. I don't think all human societies have had that. So it's only certain human societies in which that comes out and has full expression. So I think we need to deal with that kind of human society, which, you know, we call it capitalism. It comes out of earlier systems. So that's what we have to be looking at, not I think, human nature.
Well, I mean, the capitalism seems to be ruling the planet and ruining the planet. So, you know, that's the important people that take count of, and
okay.
Good luck with it. I mean, good luck with that. I mean, you got to have something where people can counter that or use it themselves and become owners of their own businesses and use that energy to help counter the bigger, you know, it's a balance of power.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling.
You're welcome.
And I just want to make a couple quick announcements before we have to go. Tonight, there's a Community Oversight Advisory Board first ever public hearing. They want to hear why you don't trust the police. That's tomorrow night, I'm sure. Sorry, Thursday, April 2 from 5:30 to 8:30 at the Charles Jordan Community Center. That's up at 9009 North Foss. And you can call V at 503-975-0835 for more information. There's also a Facebook event, PDX-COAB. This will be at the front desk. You can call and get that information. Again, April 7th, Stop the Portland Propane Terminal. Come to the hearing and rally. That's 2:15 for the rally, 3 p.m. for the hearing. And that's at 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue. Again, this will be at the front desk if you want to get more information. Occupy the Farm, Clinton Street Theater, again tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. Come see how folks occupied public land, needed to feed people, and they made it happen. The film director, Todd Darling, the Biosafety Alliance and Albina Cooperative Garden will speak afterward. And that's at the Clinton Street Theater at Southeast 26th and Clinton. Robert, again, you've been lurking in the background there for a while. What do you think about our last caller?
Well, I'm not sure what to say at this point. He left me a little bit speechless, I think. In other words, I don't have a real good response to what he said. And that's not trying to say what he said was right or wrong. But I think, Paul, what needs to come out of this kind of a forum and this kind of talk radio program that you have when we discuss issues like global warming, climate change, is let's hope what happens is that it triggers something amongst people. It triggers some thought patterns where they start to think about it more, look into it more, educate themselves more. And you know, everybody has a friend. And now that we have social media, just a click away, those friendships branch out very rapidly. And let's hopefully people, as they become more aware, share more concern, and it becomes somehow directed at our political establishment and things change. Because right now, going forward, we have got one hell of a mess on our hands when we have a Republican right-wing Congress in control, and they're not about to do one damn thing about global warming. In fact, they deny it. They deny it, and it's real. It's very real, very dangerous, and we need to do something about it. So I think everybody on this radio program who's listening needs to become an activist, and everybody can become an activist and influence. When you become an activist, you influence 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 50, maybe 100, maybe 1,000 people. Do it. Study it. Get involved. And that's my message. And I think the more people that do that, it's funny how things spread, isn't it? All of a sudden it spreads, it spreads, it spreads. And the political power of the people becomes too much. The People's March in New York City last September showed everybody something. And that is, it can happen. And that was very powerful. It wasn't just in New York City. There were 57,000 the same day representing the same thing in the streets of Melbourne. There were 20,000 in the streets of Brasilia on the same day, in London, in Paris, marching in unison. So you bring people together, and that's a powerful force. That's what we got to do. And it all has to do with education and awareness.
Well, let's try to get one more caller in. Gordon, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. So good conversation. You know, and I just want to say that we do have ego, and the ego is driven by greed. You know, it's driven through, you know, pretty things and nice things and stuff. So our egos really get in the way of making decisions properly because we get blinded by greed and power and stuff. So, so that guy was on the right point in that it is ingrained in us to be ego. It is our ego that keeps us alive, and so that's what makes us make bad decisions.
Well, I think that's a much bigger conversation that we're actually not going to be able to have, and I think I addressed it earlier in the same way. In certain social contexts, you know, ego or greed are expressed in different ways. So we have to create recreate a kind of social context in which those things are kept in check. Sorry, I'm not going to be able to let you go on because we're just out of time, and I got to make a couple more announcements. Coming up at 9 on Political Perspectives, How the West Caused the Crisis in Ukraine. Check out a new article in Street Roots. And hey, you know, Street Roots, if you can support them, they're doing some really good journalism these days. What does Portland's plan for new fossil fuel operations mean for the Columbia River Gorge and beyond? That's in Street Roots, out on the streets today. Robert Hunsaker, thank you so much. You got a minute if you want to share any other thoughts.
I do, and my plea is to your audience, please become an activist because it feels real good. It really does. And I think you've got a lot of really bright people in Portland. Very bright audience, and Portland's could lead the way. So I hope the people of Portland, you know, do whatever they can to make an impact. And I know it takes one by one by one by one. If you keep adding it up, all of a sudden you got a million. You know, one person by one person by one person by one. If everyone becomes an activist, then we're in good shape.
And we got lots of opportunities with the planned propane terminals, oil trains, coal trains, export terminals, and the opportunities are endless. It's a growth field. I've been listening to a Robert Hunsaker, journalist, article out on Counterpunch called Apocalyptic Meltdown, The Nightmare is Underway. Many other writings. Check them out. My name is Paul Rowland. This is KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
That shadow in the footage, it was probably me. I'm the rumor, I'm the doubt, I'm the lie. But you wouldn't stand near me if you didn't want to die. Everything you know is wrong. There's a verse missing out of this song. Everything you know is wrong.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the 4th Annual Umbrella Festival of Circus and Comedy, April 2nd to April 5th at the Alberta Rose Theatre. Four nights of entertainment, including outsider music legend Artist the Spoon Man, nine traveling circus troupes, acrobats and aerialists, clowns and cabaret, bands and burlesque, drag and daring do, and more. Again, that's the 4th Annual Umbrella Festival of Circus and Comedy, April 2nd through April 5th at the Alberta Rose Theatre, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film Occupy the Farm, playing at the Clinton Street Theater Thursday, April 2nd at 6:30 p.m.
Our main concern is water right now.
The university actually shut off our water.
What we're going to be doing is handing buckets over the fence.
Occupy the Farm tells the inspiring story.